Good morning and welcome to Grand Rounds. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Roy Katzen. Dr. Roy Katzen's on staff here at the Marcus Neuroscience Center. His education is he went to the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine and to Rutgers, and he's training his residency in neurology at University of Miami Hospitals. He did his internship and residency there, and he was employed for years at South Florida Neurology Associates. He works for SOC, which is a telemedicine, teleneurology practice, as well as working here at the Marcus Neuroscience Institute at Boca Regional. He's certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology, and he's a member of the American Academy of Neurology. Roy held many hospital executive staff positions, including at Delray and here at Boca Regional, and is directed the Stroke Center over at Delray Hospital. Roy's topic this morning is migraine, and please join me in welcoming Dr. Katzen.
Talk a little bit first about the history of migraine. Many years ago, a theory of migraine generation was that it was due to something called cortical spreading depression, or CSD, discovered in the 1940s. At the time, it was believed to be the major mechanism for migraine, but presently we understand this as an epiphenomenon, a possible migraine generator. It is associated with some migraine symptoms. Several years later, it was discovered that serotonin, which is an endogenous neurotransmitter, was identified as active in migraine, and it was initially recognized as a vasoconstrictor, but we now understand it to affect many physiologic functions.
Put that in the auto.
Okay. Okay. A research on serotonergic agents led to the development of triptans, which are still in use today as a primary abortive approach to migraine, which we'll talk about a little bit later, the first experimentally based approach to acute migraine treatment. So over the past 20 years, research has cast doubt on the vascular or vasoconstrictive theory of migraine because variations in blood flow occur during the headache phase, and triptans may also help via non-vascular mechanisms. So current evidence suggests that there's a variety of different mechanisms. We'll talk about the newest in a few minutes, but CNS dysfunction, neurogenic inflammation, activation of meningeal nociceptors are all involved, along with a new neuropeptide that's been discovered. The trigeminal vascular system is now recognized as a key player in the development of migraine and related pain, and it's based in large part on a neuropeptide called calcitonin gene-related peptide, one of the most abundant neuropeptides within this system, and it probably is the central generator for migraine. Over the past 30 to 40 years, an organization called the International Headache Society has generated a classification system, which has been revised on a couple of occasions, the last about 2 years ago in the journal Cephalalgia. And neurologists use this as the basis of how to think about migraine classification nowadays. There's been a lot of consolidation in this field. We now think of migraine in terms of headache classification as migraine without aura, migraine with aura, and chronic migraine. There's a lot of other terminology and phrases out there that you've heard of over the years, which I'm going to talk about, but this is the way to think about migraine in this day and age. Migraine is highly prevalent and underdiagnosed. 38 million Americans are affected. It's especially common in women of childbearing age. It's the seventh leading cause of disability worldwide. The peak age distribution is young, but it can occur at any age. Pediatric and elderly patients can have new onset migraine. And it's variable in terms of its frequency, duration, and severity on an individualized basis. It can be unilateral. It can be bilateral. It doesn't have to be throbbing. It can be mild, moderate, severe. And one important take-home message for today is that any headache with nausea, sensitivity to light, and decreased function is most likely migraine. One of the ways to distinguish migraine from other headaches is that the patient will lie down in a dark, quiet room and say, "Leave me alone." That's what I mean by decreased function. headaches that are agitating are very different in most cases. Migraine often has triggers. The triggers most commonly are hormonal or psychosocial, but they can also be environmental. Irregular eating patterns, lack of sleep. Dietary triggers are well recognized, such as NutraSweet. Caffeine's a peculiar one because some people, including me, who have migraine, have their headaches relieved by caffeine. MSG, alcohol, cheese, Italian red wines in particular, and processed or cured meats are important. Certain medications patients will believe are triggers for them, but probably the most common is stress and anxiety. Now, despite the fact that these triggers exist and are often well recognized by patients, eliminating the triggers don't often stop the headaches. So there are no confirmatory randomized trials regarding lifestyle changes in particular. In addition to the classic aura, migraine may have a prodrome lasting many, many hours and a postdrome or after effects. May precede and follow headache by several hours, and some triggers may actually be part of the prodrome in particular. So patients, and this is actually something that I've come to recognize, is that yawning is a very important prodrome for patients. Nausea, changes in mood, sensitivity to light, sound, and smell. Neck pain is an under-recognized trigger or part of the prodrome, and just a complaint of generalized feeling out of sorts and fatigue. The actual aura is typically much shorter, 10 to 30 minutes, rarely more than an hour. Most commonly, it's visual, and it's positive, meaning people will see spots, flashing lights, zigzag lines, colors. I saw a patient the other night on the internet who said, "I was seeing Christmas lights." And that's different than a loss of vision or a lack, a blurring, or blackness of vision. So there are positive visual phenomena, and one of the classic is called fortification spectra, or seeing the top of a castle that shimmers and moves. Some patients also will have somatosensory phenomena, vertigo, nausea, trouble with speech, and then an interesting phenomenon called allodynia, where normal touch is very unpleasant, even painful for patients. It's a classic migraine prodrome symptom. The criteria for migraine without aura are that there has to be at least 5 attacks lasting 4 to 72 hours. At least 2 attacks are unilateral, pulsating, moderate to severe, aggravated by and causing avoidance of physical activity. And typically, there's some degree of nausea or sensory stimulation sensitivity. And then the last, which is sort of in every classification scheme here, is that there's no better diagnosis for it. We'll come to what that means later. If you open up the actual international classification scheme, it'll look like this. So I'm just summarizing the scheme for you, but this is what's published. Same idea. Migraine with aura occurs in about 30% of migraineurs. We used to call this complicated migraine, complex migraine, retinal, hemiplegic. Those names have been discarded because they're too specific and variable. The aura itself may occur before, during, or sometimes even after the headache pain, and it is associated, migraine with aura, is associated with an increased risk of stroke via a variety of different mechanisms. The two most important are PFO, which occurs with a higher incidence in migraine patients, and genetics. There is a disease called CADASIL, which is associated with the NOTCH3 gene, which is autosomal dominant. There's also autosomal recessive version called CARASIL, and these are genetic diseases where migraine and stroke run together in families. The diagnostic criteria for migraine with aura is that there are at least 1 reversible aura type, at least 3 aura symptom characteristics, 2 or more in succession, they last a typical time frame, they have positive visual change, and then the headache occurs with or after or sometimes before, as I mentioned, and there's no better diagnosis. And this is the more detailed version of that. Migraine should also be should always, I should say, be thought of as having red flags. You want to think, is this really migraine, which in most circumstances people think of as a diagnosis of exclusion? It really isn't. There are characteristics that help you decide that, but there are certain things that make you stop and think. The first is, regardless of age, if it's the first time ever, if it's unusually prolonged in duration, either the headache pain or the aura, if there's an abnormality that you see on the exam, their exam should be normal, and if they have associated signs such as fever, stiff neck, rash, recent weight loss, these are obviously things to make you pause in terms of your diagnosis. In terms of how you evaluate a patient, obviously a complete history is most important. The exam is almost always normal, so your goal is to take a thorough enough history to really understand what the presentation is like. If the patient has a characteristic presentation in a normal exam, there is no need for routine brain imaging, such as CT or MRI. Most of the time, though, when I see a patient with migraine, they've had that already. So it's being done far too often in the community, probably is unnecessary for most patients with a classical presentation. In certain circumstances, of course, you're going to consider labs, most importantly, a SED rate, looking for vasculitis, imaging, and then in certain circumstances, lumbar puncture. So getting on to treatment, whatever you do for the patient, the sooner you do it, the better. The longer you wait to treat, the less effective the treatment's going to be. And we want to avoid excessive treatment because another headache classification is something we call nowadays medication overuse headache. It used to be called analgesic rebound. Patients with this condition are taking too many analgesics. They have at least 15 out of 30 headache days a month and at least 10 days where they're taking something. So it doesn't have to be that they take it every day. It can be at least a third of the month, and they do that for at least 3 months. I had a patient in my office about a month ago, or a couple months ago, came in saying, I'm having headaches every day and nothing works. And I said, what are you doing for them? And he whipped out a bottle of ibuprofen and said, I'm taking 1,000 of these a month. We stopped the ibuprofen, got rid of his gastritis, and his headaches were gone in about 10 days. So that was a dramatic response, but this is a very under-recognized and common presentation. So in terms of what is used for abortive therapies, analgesics are the most common. Ergots are still used, DHE in particular. I will still occasionally hospitalize a patient, give them IV DHE, and teach them how to give it to themselves intramuscularly in some circumstances. Triptans are the mainstay of therapy. There's probably 8 or 9 of them on the market now. There's combination therapies with analgesics. They're all generics. They're easy to get. They still are expensive, though. Probably each triptan pill is $30 to $40 per pill. So you'll find if you prescribe them that the pharmacy is going to give them 8, and that's supposed to last 2 months. In the ER, you'll see used steroids, IV magnesium, 100% oxygen sometimes breaks headaches. I still think there's a place for phenothiazines in these patients. Some of the older neurologists in the room know about that. The newest are external neuromodulation devices, which I'm going to show you, and then drugs called Gepants, which are the newest on the market. Getting to chronic migraine, the definition is at least 15 days a month for at least 3 months, or at least 8 days a month with a response to abortive therapies, and again, no better diagnosis. And this is the more detailed version of that. So particularly with chronic migraine patients, we want to consider preventative therapies, but it's reasonably used for just about anybody with migraine. To give you an example, an 18-wheeler truck driver can't afford to have a migraine while driving cross-country. Migrainous stroke or TIA patients typically deserve to go on preventive therapies to avoid recurrent events. So everybody's a candidate in individual circumstances. There are a variety of different ways we approach treating migraine preventively. In some very motivated patients, you don't need a medication. So some patients benefit from biofeedback, cognitive behavioral therapy, physical therapy, massage. Occipital nerve blocks occasionally work, even if it's not occipital neuralgia for some reason. and then acupuncture has a place as well. In terms of prophylactic therapies and nonspecific oral agents, you want to choose the side effect profile to benefit the patient. It's a very important concept because, as you'll see, there are certain medicines that have a lot of benefits for patients. So plant extracts are sometimes still used. Feverfew and butterbur have a place. Coenzyme Q, B vitamins, oral magnesium. I don't use a lot of that, but you'll see that used. In terms of nonspecific prescription drugs, the most common are antihypertensives. It used to be verapamil, now candesartan is very commonly used for migraine patients who happen also to have hypertension or SVT or other problems like that. Probably the most common class nowadays are the anticonvulsant class, particularly topiramate, because it has a tendency to cause appetite suppression. So it's a very trendy preventive drug in young, overweight women with migraine. Tricyclics work very, very well. It's just that the side effect profile limits their use. So a small amount of amitriptyline or nortriptyline at night is very efficacious for some patients. Botox is still being used very commonly. It's FDA approved for migraine, for chronic migraine, I should say. The problem with Botox is that there are multiple insurance and financial hurdles to its use. It's very expensive. Most drug companies that cover it nowadays require step edits. And probably most importantly for us, treatments and art. It really takes an experienced neurologist to know how to administer Botox. I've seen it given by cosmetic ophthalmologists and other doctors, and I think that they don't treat a lot of patients with it, and they tend to do poorly. So ultimately, you want an experienced neurologist. And I think this is going to fall out of favor due to newer options that are coming to market over the past year and in the next year. We have four FDA-approved non-invasive neuromodulation devices that some patients use for acute and preventive migraine. Cervical or vagus nerve stimulation, occipital nerve transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, back here actually, and then frontal or supraorbital nerve stimulation. The newest is this arm band, which functions as a neurostimulator. And they look something like this. So the device is held over the area in question. This is the cephali, the most common, which is the supraorbital stimulator. And these devices, the first one is for acute use, and the rest are used regularly for chronic therapies, are pretty effective, but you don't see much use of these because there's no payment coverage. They're $300 to $400 per device, and patients really don't want to pay for it just to try it out. So I don't see a lot of use of this, but it does exist in our armamentarium. So that brings us to the modern therapy of migraine. Calcitonin gene-related peptide is a 37 amino acid neuropeptide marker of primary afferent neurons. It's a member of the calcitonin family of peptides. It's a very potent vasodilator, but we're not certain that that's the mechanism where it's involved. It's distributed in both the central and peripheral nervous systems, dorsal root ganglia, trigeminal root ganglia, which is very important, even the spinal cord and the GI tract. The reason we now know the involvement of CGRP is that plasma levels increase during a migraine attack and normalize after the attack is over. An infusion of this neuropeptide induces migraine-like attacks with a history in patients that have a history of migraine. Six different small molecule receptor antagonists have demonstrated efficacy. The newest one is ibrogepant or gepant version, and that one is actually coming to market. It was highlighted in the New England Journal of Medicine about 3 weeks ago. The small molecule receptor antagonists show efficacy both in abortive and prevention trials. We also have three neutralizing antibodies which have been on the market for over a year. These are monthly injections for preventive therapies, and we've had pretty good success with these drugs. They work very well. So the two mechanisms of action that are on the market now are antibodies to the neuropeptide and then receptor blockers. This is the newest approach to treatment. It may help within a week. That's been my experience, that some of these patients feel immediate relief with these injections. They have fewer migraine headache days, increased activity. And the nice thing about these drugs is that they don't cross the blood-brain barrier, so we don't see dizziness, sedation, or any of the other side effects of the nonspecific approaches that are out there. There are minimal risks, typically injection site reactions, and probably constipation is a common side effect, I would say, with these drugs I've seen. But otherwise, I've never seen a hypersensitivity reaction. Theoretically, you can see neutralizing antibodies with them, and we don't use them in pregnant women. Has not been studied. So the three drugs that are on the market are Aimovig, Ajovy, and Emgality. The oral drug coming to market in some markets, I think it's already available, is Zydis. And again, these are not the gepants. These are a different mechanism. These are antibodies. So the gepants are small molecule receptor antagonists. The one that's been approved is ubrogepant. And the approach will be 150 to 100 milligram dose. A second dose is possible. It works. Side effects are nausea, somnolence, and dry mouth. And most likely, this is going to be one of the most effective new options out there. Going back to triptans, we have oral triptans, we have injectable and inhalable triptans, but patients typically desire a pill in most circumstances. And this pill will probably replace a lot of other options as it comes to market and sees increased use. Questions?
If the inhibitor doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier, how does it work?
Well, the trigeminal vascular system is a system of nerve endings in layman's terms. It's distributed throughout the meninges in part. So that you don't need to cross the blood-brain barrier to get to the meninges. So I don't think the mechanism is really well, you know, completely thought out or completely described as of yet, but that's one of the theories.
The second question, the increased risk of stroke is worrisome. Are we supposed to look at our young females with migraines now as a pre-stroke patient, considering some kind of a prophylactic schedule?
No, I don't think in a routine migraine without aura or chronic migraine situation. But if you have migraine with aura, that's the circumstance where stroke risk is increased, and in particular if they smoke and if they're on hormones. So if I have a migraine with aura patient who's on hormonal therapy for contraception, I encourage them to find alternative means of birth control, and I try to discourage smoking. So I think risk factor management is really the mainstay of therapy, not automatically putting them on prophylactic drugs. So Todd's paralysis is really something that you see in a seizure patient. So the eponym refers to the patient who has a focal onset of seizures. Let's say they have a right hemisphere seizure focus, and they present with a focal seizure with or without secondary generalization, and they're weak on that side. So they have clonic activity on the left side, left arm and leg, and then after the seizure is over, they're paralyzed on that side for a period of hours. It gets better over the time course, and by the next day, typically, the weakness is gone. So that's Todd's paralysis. That's different than a migraine patient who has a TIA. So we don't apply that term, but the phenomenon is pretty similar. Kenny?
So what effect does someone with pre-existing migraines becomes pregnant? Does pregnancy have a positive effect on migraines? Do you have less frequent migraines or more frequent?
So in a majority of patients, their migraine gets better. So in terms of abortive therapies, you need a lot less of it. And generally, we try to stick with Tylenol and narcotics in those patients. We try to avoid anything else. After they deliver, it comes back with a vengeance a lot of times. So during the pregnancy, it's pretty easy to manage those patients. And generally, you're going to avoid preventative drugs. So we encourage them to come off the drugs before a planned pregnancy. Sedation. I think when you have an ER patient, we're not we're not treating with mechanistic approaches. We're trying to get them through it and get them out of the ER, right? So analgesics, sedation, anti-nausea, and that's the approach typically. But phenothiazines work very well.
You talked very briefly about the mechanical devices. And from what I heard, the efficacy to use them is the cost. What I didn't hear was the efficacy of the
So I'm not hesitant to use them. I just find that patients typically don't want to pay for the devices just to see if they might work. You know, there's no way to get them any other way than buying them. But in my experience, the device that you put in the forehead, which is the most commonly used, is reasonably effective as part of your armamentarium. It's not going to be the sole treatment for any of these patients. By the time you get to that, you know, they've been on a lot of different things. And they've been to different neurologists. They've tried a lot of different approaches. And so it's something that would be part of the armamentarium. My mother swears by it. I haven't seen it used a lot in this circumstance. In my practice, the use of those chemicals are primarily in chronic neurologic diseases like Parkinsonism, MS, occasional epilepsy patients. I haven't seen migraine patients go to it very often. So the term is an archaic term, but what it means is unexplained nausea, typically in a pediatric age patient with recurrent nausea and goes from GI doctor to GI doctor to GI doctor without a diagnosis until somebody comes up with the bright idea that it's a form of aura of migraine. So it's nausea without headache. Any other questions? We don't have any on the market yet. But theoretically, I think I showed something in terms of potentials. Well, so nausea, somnolence, dry mouth are what are reported.
This is a kind of an anecdote. The retiring doctor I bought my practice from 20 years ago used to do liquid cocaine through the nose to the back of the throat, sphenopalatine procedure, which was advocated by an ENT doctor in Manhattan for treatment of his migraine patients. Now, obviously, liquid cocaine is not something that's going to be practical, but is there any work on dealing with that receptor in the back of the throat?
Not in the neurology community. I'm aware of some ENT literature on it, but no. Well, I mentioned that in the discussion about prodrome, is things like mood swings and fatigue, very nonspecific complaints. I think in retrospect, we recognize them as part of a precursor to migraine. But they're so nonspecific that there's not any specific treatment that you would advise. I think when you take a thorough history, you're going to hear patients mention that for days before a bad attack, you know, they felt crappy and they had these kinds of nonspecific complaints. I don't. I just think there are observations that are typical. Okay. All right. Well, thank you.